to take part in the Christmas card stream. Now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
To understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm now here with Cameron McGregor. A lot of people will know Cameron from his appearances on The Backlash recently, an American podcast. But you have been active in our circles for some time. Cameron, would you briefly introduce yourself to the audience?
I'm happy to do so, although this is my least favorite part. I am not very good at self-promotion, but I'll just say I'm an investor, an entrepreneur. I'm also a YouTuber and a co-host on The Backlash. I have a Substack called Men in the City, and my YouTube channel is called at Neo-Masculinity, and I'm on some of the other social media platforms as well.
And they should be linked in the description below for those interested. So, we're going to talk about, we'll start with the events of this year. I generally find that's a good place to start with. This has been a very full year, I would say, in terms of events in America, events in Britain, across Europe, and geopolitically. So we came up with a list of things before we started. And the first thing is if we go chronologically, the ongoing trouble in Ukraine, with Russia and Ukraine. So that obviously goes back to well before 2025, well before when the actual thing started. But nonetheless, please give your perspective on that whole conflict, what you think of.
Right. So let's try to reframe a little bit where the world stands today, because I sense, particularly from folks in the West, that there is a pervasive sense of doom and gloom, a foreboding, if you will, that the world is becoming increasingly unstable, that conflict around the world is intensifying and spreading. And actually speaking, that's not really the case. So as somebody who's been to over 30 countries and lived quite literally all over the world, to include Asia, South America, I'm currently in Eastern Europe, obviously, I am from the United States. The world has already changed, and this is not widely appreciated, particularly in the Anglosphere. So whether you're talking about the city of London or you're talking about New York City, from their bird's eye, what they see is their sort of grasp, their handle, their hegemony slipping away, and a kind of tyranny and authoritarianism rising in Eurasia, led by the Russians, rising presumably in the Middle East, led by subversive states like Iran, and certainly led by the Chinese tiger in East Asia. But if we consider their perspective, the Russians, the Persians, the Chinese, their view is quite literally the opposite of that. And I want to talk specifically about China and Russia, because these are two countries I've been to and have some familiarity with, especially China. I would say there are three commonalities that both of these countries have, and it stands diametrically opposed to the United States. The first is that these countries are aware of their problems. So they're all sort of in a developmental process, but they are self-aware. They are conscious of that, and they are taking rigorous steps, in some cases, planned steps to fix their problems. The second is that they have a very specific awareness, consciousness of their national identity. And because of that, they know what their national interests are, and they are advancing their national interests strategically. Thirdly, though they have their problems, some of which I can elaborate on to be sure, and they do have some very big problems indeed, they have technically competent leadership. And what I mean specifically by that, Colin, is they have capable executives that can actually navigate the machinery of government from A to Z. In that regard, life is actually getting better. So you have to remember that both Russia and China have gone through at least a century, if not two centuries, of tremendous despair and hardship. The Chinese emerged from the century of humiliation, which they were effectively dominated, subjugated by foreign powers, and failed, and I would say failed spectacularly to resist. And what followed was a century of absolute destruction at the hands of Mao Zedong. So you had not just domination by Japan, but eventually internal decay, followed by the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, all of this sort of turmoil until they get to Deng Xiaoping. And from Deng Xiaoping forward, everything basically starts to get better. And I would argue over the last 20 years, it has started to really accelerate. In Russia, the last 100 years, really until Vladimir Putin became the head of Russia, things were pretty bad in the Russian Federation, not just during the Soviet period either, which I think at this stage is pretty well known. Obviously, we know about the destructive nature of the Bolshevik Revolution, which was about 100 years ago, and the Bolshevik Revolution, which destroyed the Romanovs, it destroyed in many ways the connectivity of Russia with the West, and led to a Stalinist period, which was far worse than I think anything we can imagine in the Anglosphere or in Western Europe. And then eventually comes the collapse of the Soviet Union, the sort of disintegration of the Russian Empire, if you want to call it that. And then they plunge into the 90s when they're sort of lost and drunk, sort of like Yeltsin, and their country is torn apart and pillaged largely by bankers from the West under the umbrella of shock therapy, which was the idea that they would rapidly, that we would help the Russians rapidly transition into a sort of capitalist society. That was a sort of a euphemism for raping and plundering the country. But then comes Vladimir Putin, and I would say over the last 20, 25 years, the country has finally regained a sense of itself. So from their point of view, their livelihoods, the livelihoods of their citizenry, their sort of self-confidence is returning. That does not mean that it is an aggressive self-confidence. It does not mean that it is an expansive self-confidence, as is widely feared in the West. It does not operate that way at all. But in both the Chinese and the Russian sense, what these powers want is respect. What they want is sort of a seat at the table of global governance. And well, to be clear, we have denied them that, and we have vilified them, sanctioned them, tariffed them, or otherwise tried to subvert and undermine their authority in their own country. And so, quite obviously, their response to this has not been very positive. That finally came to a head in 2022 with the special military operation, which, frankly, for anybody that's studied Ukraine or understands the expansion of NATO since the 90s, that was all but a foregone conclusion. However, what has happened since the war has started has actually been spectacularly good, particularly for the West. It's been good in the sense that it has utterly weakened the foundations of the European Union. The bureaucracy that dominates Western Europe has been, I think, summarily discredited. And it's done a lot of damage to the elites in Washington, D.C. as well. It's come at an extremely high cost, but it has, to some degree, exposed the lie of this sort of globalist paradigm. And it has built a wall, I would argue an impregnable fortress, one that's gone up in Ukraine, one that's gone up in East Asia, and one that I think is increasingly going up with Iran in the Middle East against the forces of globalism in the West, which, as you know, Colin, is a kind of virus that is now turning in on itself and eating itself apart. So what I would argue is that the West is in a state of absolute disarray at the moment, but the rest of the world is actually accumulating a sense of self-confidence, direction, and industrial power. And that is a force of stability. And we are now exiting a very temporary period of Pax Americana that's gone horribly wrong, but the rest of the world has kind of checked that tyranny. And so now I think we have the opportunity, provided that we get a better sense of leadership, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, but provided we can avoid an escalation, and that is a very real danger, we can, I think, go into a much more stable, albeit multipolar and more widely distributed world in terms of power. So the world is not anarchical. It's not descending into Hobbesian anarchy, but the West is a frazzled mess. And as a result, there's a lot of danger that could be done because the elites in Europe and in the United States sense that they're losing control and they're lashing out. So that's more or less where we are, Colin.
It is surprising that the West would, or specifically America, would be in this position while under the presidency of Donald Trump, because supposedly he's called himself a nationalist. He speaks in those terms about America first, building up America, making it great again. And yet what you seem to be saying is that he, or at least his administration, are still married to a globalistic paradigm and aren't seizing the opportunities presented by current events. What would you say about that?
Yes. So Nietzsche, I think, said in the Genealogy of Morals, if a temple is to be erected, a temple must be destroyed. The premise of the Trump administration was always that you could get revolutionary change without a revolution, that you could transform the machinery of government via the popular will, which has been irrelevant for 50 years. That was always an illusion. And unfortunately, it is an illusion that's dying 1,000 deaths. And I suspect it's going to come in the throes of a tremendous financial crisis. Let's hope it's not brought down by some kind of geopolitical mess. But no, Donald Trump is a marketing guy. And I would dare say that he is very much a product of the political class that he argues he's changing. And if you look at the people that staff his government, if you look at a lot of the policies that he's tried to advance, whether you're talking about threatening other countries that are exiting the dollar, or trying to sort of spar with the Chinese in East Asia over Taiwan, or now escalating tensions in Venezuela, what does that sound like? It sounds like continuity. It sounds like exactly the kind of foreign affairs that we had before. Now, domestically, where a lot of folks think, well, yeah, we're sort of incrementally moving in the right direction, I would argue that President Trump was elected this go-round to do three things. One was to disengage from the forever wars overseas. And as I just mentioned a moment ago, I think categorically speaking, that has absolutely not happened. The military-industrial complex, the empire, the Zionists that run the United States, they are more emboldened than ever. So that pillar has been lost. The second pillar was to reorg the government. This is really what Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency were supposed to accomplish. They were supposed to get control of America's runaway fiscal spending by restructuring the government. Well, that lasted about 6 months, and Elon Musk was asked to leave rather impolitely, and that descended into a sort of childish sparring between Trump and Musk on Twitter, which I think gave people a better sense of the clowns that are actually running the Western countries in general, not just the United States, than they realize. But Elon Musk was out, and he was out for a simple reason. He wanted to go in and rewire the government, which is a big part of the story, Colin. This is not just about turning away foreigners that have overwhelmed the United States or other countries in Western Europe. This is about updating, upgrading, modernizing the U.S. government, and I would argue governments across the West, which are a discombobulated mess, despite a lot of the conspiracy theories that you hear advanced, certainly in our circles. There is no monolithic organizational structure that's governing any of this. It's just a sort of spaghetti mess of agencies with all kinds of factions and rogue interests that are pulling in all kinds of different directions. In any case, the way to tackle that was to follow Elon Musk's plan. It was to attack the budget that was dismissed And so any attempt to reorganize the government or retrench the United States fiscally, that's over. That's failed. And the third pillar was to reindustrialize the United States and by extension sort of reinstitute sovereignty. Well, this has been a spectacular failure. And the reason it's been a failure is because the president of the United States, like most of his advisors, does not understand the principal problem that's bedeviling the United States and its citizenry. And that is that the two allocators of capital, that being Wall Street on the East Coast and Silicon Valley on the West Coast, they are effectively merchants of finance that are harvesting the United States economy for parts. And they've been engaging in this for a long, long time. And they've weaponized the dollar and leveraged our status as the world reserve currency to do it. Trump has doubled down on protecting Wall Street. In fact, I would argue that his administration has been dominated by Wall Street gambits like the Genius Act, for example, or democratizing 401k investments so that boomers can be exposed to private equity investments, which are Ponzi schemes, more or less. And I can explain more if your audience is interested in that. But the short of it is that the very agents of the destruction of the U.S. economy and the deindustrialization, people like Howard Lutnick, who's the Commerce Secretary, people like Secretary Bessent, who comes from Wall Street, they're the same people. So what they're doing is doubling down on the same policies that arguably blew up the U.S. economy and provoked the Trump election to begin with. But Donald Trump doesn't really understand that. He's part of the problem. And so his administration has, I would argue, imploded internally. And it's only a matter of time now before the rest of the country figures that out. I think there's a growing awareness of that, certainly in what's called America First. But a lot of more mainstream Republicans, they haven't figured that out yet. But I think we're getting closer because there is an economic catastrophe that is in progress in the U.S. It's not on the horizon. It's happening. And what the president is doing is what he's always done. He gaslights anybody who disagrees with his policies. He gaslights anyone who challenges the golden age that he supposedly christened. That's not going to work this time. We are facing a kind of economic crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen in the United States since the 1930s. And as I said, I don't think Trump appreciates that. If he did, he certainly wouldn't be throwing Great Gatsby parties in Mar-a-Lago. And that, it seems, is what he's doing. So the short of it is, it was a gambit, Colin, and it was another charade that the public was sold to maintain this fiction of democracy. However, the good news is this. When Trump fails, that means that 50 years of populism in the United States is over. It's been invalidated. It means that the democratic system as we understand it is temporarily, if not permanently, jettisoned. And that's a very good thing, because if we're going to solve our problems, we need to transition into something new. That is what I call succession. That is exactly where Great Britain is headed as well. It's where the French Fifth Republic is headed. We are entering into a very different kind of politics. I call it metapolitics, but it's going to be post-democratic, and it's going to be a kind of game, if you want to call it that, that we can win, because this sort of faux democracy is a game that's rigged against us.
All right. Well, there are loads of things to pick up on there. And just briefly, it seems to me, and it has seemed to me for quite some time, that a problem with America and America's political system is that for whatever reason, it seems to be geared towards old men. And so you have a sort of gerontocracy, I don't know how to pronounce that, but where it's always that the president, part with the exception of Obama and I guess Bill Clinton, the president always seems to be an old man. And this just seems inherently to be a bad idea, to bode badly, because you're going to have presidents who are fundamentally conservative in that very broad sense that they just want to maintain the status quo and are going to be very averse to any kind of shakeup of the system and won't even understand the modern world around them because they're in their 60s or 70s or whatever. Would you agree with that? Would you agree that that is an inherent problem?
You know, it's funny. I was at an event in Poland a couple months ago, And it was a nationalist event to celebrate the 1,000-year anniversary of a battle in Sardinia. Sardinia is on the German border between the Poles and the Germans. And this is considered one of the foundational events of Polish national identity. So you had a lot of folks that were there, primarily people that were a bit older. But there were some Germans there, there were Hungarians there were Poles there. And so I was sitting at a table with a number of these folks, and they were characteristically black-pilled, is the best way to look at it. Basically, they think that the West is over, that we're screwed, that we can't possibly regain a sense of ourselves. And so what we've got to do is sort of defend the little turf that's left that we haven't ceded to anybody. Now, the reason I mention that is because while you're not wrong, Colin, yes, we do have a gerontocracy. In fact, I've used that term in a lot of my writing, but it's a gerontocracy of spirit. And I would argue that this is pervasive in the entire Anglo world. And that gerontocracy of spirit is sort of the bankruptcy of imagination. We on the right, and I don't like that term. And just to be clear with you, I am not a dissident. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a traditionalist. I'm none of those things. Because those things, while I think virtuous in many ways, they are constraining. They restrict what is possible in the mind and the spirit. You know, we have to go back to the way the old things have been done. And it sort of checkmates you. Right? It invalidates your ability to reorganize your thoughts and adapt to a world that's changing in ways that actually favor a lot of the views that we have, right? We are in a kind of free fall in a philosophical sense. However, what is spectacularly good, and I think it started about 10 years ago, around 2014 or 2015, I suppose you could say it started in 2010, around the time YouTube got started. I don't know, Colin, when you got into YouTube, probably around then. What happened was a kind of embryonic stage because of a financial catastrophe that permanently disrupted the 9-to-5 paradigm for men under 40 today, or around 40 and younger. So these would be Gen Z and millennials. And when that 9-to-5 was disrupted, not only did we find ourselves unable to access the pathways of life that our parents had, and in many ways it was bestowed upon them without much difficulty, right? Because our parents didn't fight in the world wars per se, right? They weren't the greatest generation. They were the baby boomers. They were the Gen Xers, maybe some of the older Gen Xers. And while they experienced a lot of upheaval, the fundamental social structure of Western countries was more or less intact. And that hasn't changed. That had not changed, I would argue, until about 2000, 2010. And 2008, you could bookmark as a pivotal event because that destroyed this sort of pathway. And that cast an entire generation into the ditch. Those of us that suffered because of that event, that, as I said, were denied the pathway to a university and then to a job and then to a wife and then to a family and then to children and then to perhaps living in the suburbs, right, to speak as an American. The majority of us were cast aside in that. But in addition to that, all of a sudden we found ourselves villainized by virtue of being white men. We were the perennial villains. We were the problem. So all the social ills in society, whether it was racism or feminism or misogyny, any number of these ailments, we were the cause celeb that has ruined everybody's day. And so on the one hand, our lives are getting worse. We've sort of been expelled from mainstream society. And at the same time, we're being blamed for all the shit that's gone wrong. The good news, however, is that what that did is it permanently disconnected us from the matrix. It sort of led us to a kind of alchemical awakening. And yes, there was a lot of anger. There's a lot of rage, but that is sort of the fire of Heraclitus that set off in our brains and opened our minds to new ideas. And those new ideas were cultivated in the manosphere, in the red pill community, in the alternative media complex, which, as I have written for a long time now, have become the root and branch of a kind of spiritual or psycho-spiritual mass mobilization that has happened in the Western world. And the way I would sort of describe it visually to your audience is, if you think in terms of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, if you go to the Return of the King, it's sort of when the beacons were lit at Gondor to alert, to ask for help, right? To ask for aid. And all of a sudden you see these beacons lit from mountaintop to mountaintop. That is effectively what has happened for all Western men, I would say from about 45 years of age and younger, and a good share of the older generation as well. And that new awareness is that, hey, we may not have a vision yet of exactly what this succession, this rise of a new order is, but we know that the old ways are over, that we cannot do things the way we've done them in the past, and that this sort of blissful 9-to-5 track to suburbia, that's over. That is an inescapable conclusion that we've come to. And that means mentally, psycho-spiritually, and now politically, we're achieving a sort of escape velocity. That's very dangerous to the gerontocracy, who doesn't know how to deal with this. They have tried censorship. That has failed. They have tried false flags. That has failed. They have tried sort of weaponizing government. That has failed. And now you're starting to see people go into the streets. In other words, yes, you're right. The West has sort of reached entropy at higher levels, but that doesn't mean that at the street level, we are in a worse position for it. We're not. We're sort of looking at the edifices of power and saying, what the fuck is going on? Now is our time to do something about it. And that is more or less where we are. In other words, those beacons have been lit. And what's coming now is the reconstruction team.
All right. Very inspiring words. I want to stick with some set questions, which seems a bit of a bummer, really. But I want to definitely cover some points that I think are important. You mentioned that people have a certain conspiratorial notion that in the West that our governments are hyper efficient and effective. But I think that emerged during COVID, especially. Well, I mean, it was residual just because we'd always had peace and things were stable and so on. Then COVID happened and the governments were very effective at oppressing the public, basically. And I think from that you get the, you know, theories about the WEF and so forth and the UN. But more recently, what we see is incredible incompetence. And if you think about a figure like Ursula von der Leyen, for example, I don't want to pick on her, she's just an example, but you could really use any modern Western politician. Keir Starmer is the Prime Minister in Britain, and David Lammy and so forth. What you see is incredible incompetence and stupidity and fecklessness and a certain desperation to serve an order at the expense of their own public, of course. And I think probably the epitome of this was when the Nord Stream pipeline was bombed and German politicians celebrated it, that happening. I find that absolutely astonishing because they were celebrating something that would undoubtedly economically detriment their own country and that had been done, well, partly to do that. And yet they were celebrating it. And it's like for them, principles mattered more than anything else. And the principle of fighting Putler and sticking it to that Russian dictator mattered more than their own country's chances in the future. You see it also, again, in Germany, but with other countries as well, with the opposition to nuclear power. So even if this means that China will race ahead of us in every way, we have to do this because of the principle of green energy and et cetera. And so they'll destroy themselves economically. And then that means that Germany has to deindustrialize. With Britain, similar things. And with all of these countries, of course, there's mass immigration, which is only going to worsen those countries economically. Of course, it's obvious. You've only got to look at these guys. They are not going to be doctors and lawyers and architects. It's obvious. So they're doing all of these things. And I wrote an essay about this, making this point earlier this year, that it's almost like they're fated. They're locked into a course where they have to keep doing things that are going to work against their professed goals of improving the economy, making the world safer and so forth. They cannot possibly do that. But on top of all that, you've just got this general apparent incompetence that we now have politicians who are basically stupid, nowhere near as capable as their predecessors from 50 years ago. In Britain, there's a guy called Dominic Cummings who has taught, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Dominic Cummings. No?
No, I don't know who he is.
Yeah. He was in the government as a special advisor to Boris Johnson 5 years ago, and he has since become a sort of whistleblower, saying that the British government is a complete shit show, it's a complete disaster, and that it's stuck in the past in terms of how it operates. So it's antiquated. So it's antiquated in terms of its equipment, in terms of its ways of operating, and in terms of its ideology, its attitude. So that would seem to back up everything that you've been saying. Would you say that this is true, that the Western countries today, Western Europe and Britain and America and so forth, are basically under the control of imbeciles? Would you say that that's a fitting summary?
So, no, I would not. And I think a bit of historical context is important here, and phenomenology. So this is a point I try to make all the time in my YouTube videos, as well as on the Backlash when I do make appearances there. And that is that while much of what you said is self-evidently true, Colin, that Germany is deindustrialized, it is hollowing itself out. There was never any legitimate strategy to wean itself off of dependency on Russian oil and natural gas. By the way, that the same goes for Great Britain. and certainly if you consider a broad array of policies in the United States, you mentioned open borders, but I'll go back to COVID. COVID was not well executed, in my judgment. I don't think it demonstrated a symphonic power of government at all. In fact, if you look carefully at what the COVID lockdowns did, and I know this to be true in the United States, and I do think it is also true to a lesser extent in Europe, what that did is it effectively destroyed the small business engine of the U.S. economy. And many people.
But what I mean is that they did it very efficiently. They destroyed the economy very effectively. That's what I mean when I say that it was competently done. Not that the results were desirable.
Right, but they didn't think they did that. Right, and see, again, the premise of what you're arguing is that they are clear and self-aware of what's happening. And listen, I am not a social media person. I have been all over Europe. I've met with a lot of parties, whether it's in Germany or Austria or Hungary or France, well-versed in DC politics. I have been surrounded by the elites who are elite in name only, and I can't emphasize that enough. And let me tell you what people in DC think. They think that the Russians are losing the war in Ukraine, catastrophically, I might add. They think that any evidence that you sort of submit to challenge that assertion is propaganda and that you are a Putin agent. And look, some of the evidence, circumstantially or otherwise, is pretty horrifying. I've seen numbers that suggest maybe 2 million killed in action in Ukraine on the Ukrainian side alone. Killed in action. 2 million. We haven't seen numbers like that since the Second War, Colin. It is flatly denied. It's denied in the mainstream in the West. I think it's not well understood in capital cities across Europe. That's dangerous. That's dangerous. If you don't really understand the consequences of what's happening, that's dangerous. It is absolutely the case that a lot of bureaucrats in Brussels actually believe that Europe can be solely and self-sufficiently on green energy by 2030. Now, to you and your audience, who were educated and informed people, to a large extent because you exited the matrix, you're not inside the institutions of power, okay? It's self-evident that that's not true. And moreover, you can walk through London and think, my God, what the hell is going on here? Am I in London or am I in Bangladesh? Am I in London or am I in Mumbai? But that's not necessarily the way the elites see it at all. And worse, what a lot of these people think is that things are actually getting better, that actually what they're doing is God's work, and you just don't seem to understand economy as properly structured. And I'll give you a crystal clear example of this. In the United States, there was a Substack that was recently released, and it went viral, in part because it was written by a Wall Street investor. But it was called My Life is a Lie. Now, for the last several years, Colin, in the United States, the government, specifically the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but a lot of government agencies and private instruments of economic performance have said, not only is the United States faring well economically, but we are humming along at an accelerated rate, okay? Well, this essay called My Life is a Lie basically said that if you're living below $140,000 for a household of four, you're living as working poor in the United States, primarily because of healthcare costs and childcare costs and rents and so forth. In other words, the government statistics, whose job it is to properly evaluate and approximate these things, are completely wrong. They're completely off base. And a lot of that is because we're in the throes of a paradigmatic shift around the world. In addition to that, virtually everybody I've spoken to in the United States about China thinks that the Chinese are living in some kind of Orwellian surveillance state. And at any moment, President/Premier Xi will herd everybody into gulags. Listen, I've been to China. That's not what's happening over there at all. But most of the people running these Western governments have not a clue what the hell is really going on. They don't understand what's happened in Ukraine. They don't understand what's happening economically. And they do not appreciate the degree to which the social cohesion in their countries is fragile and fracturing. No, they don't understand that. That means that we are in a very, very dangerous environment that could explode at any moment in time. And I'll explain why they don't really understand this, because for the last 50 years or more, you just have to understand that most of the institutions, the infrastructure, the corporations, the energy systems, they were built before the governing class that currently rules established themselves. They inherited, they're essentially the managerial class of an infrastructure that they did not build. And so how did you get ahead in Brussels, or how did you get ahead in DC, or how did you get ahead in New York City? You got ahead by virtue signaling, through ideological conformity. And anybody that didn't conform, anybody that raised questions about immigration, anybody that raised questions about the economy, anybody that questioned COVID, for example, they were out, gone. And just to be clear with you, I know of more than a few people in the United States, people inside the Beltway, as they call it, so close to Washington, D.C., who took shot after shot, right? So they got vaccine after vaccine after vaccine while still getting the virus. And in some cases, these people developed permanent conditions or they died. But they kept taking the vaccine because the truth is they're intoxicated as well. They consume their own product. They are actually ideologically myopic. So they are not apprised of the situation the way that a lot of people in the online right and beyond assume. So that premise, I would say, is utterly false. But that makes things even more dangerous, right? Because now you're talking about a group of people that at any moment could sort of fall through the cracks of an earthquake that they have started. And I think that's where we are.
Yeah, that's the feeling I have as well, that they are so detached from ordinary people and ordinary life that they have no grasp of what the mood on the street is in the country. And as an example of that, they are talking about war with Russia or war with China, which I think is completely unrealistic because the public just wouldn't be on board. They can gin up this notion of Putler, but China is it's so foreign to most people that they've got no idea what goes on there or how even to interface with China as a thing, because it's racially alien. So whatever, the point is that but they still don't care about it. The public don't care about China. They don't care about Russia. No matter how many times they're told that Putin is Hitler. And by the way, just for the sake of anyone listening, I'm not a supporter of Putin. I've got no dog in that fight at all. I'm just observing and discussing this. So the public, I don't think you wouldn't get enough young men to be able to fight a war. So I think when you hear elite politicians talking about that, even as a possibility, I think they're completely deluded and detached.
Well, look, let's just talk specifics, okay? In the United Kingdom, there have been some prominent military officers, I think flag officers, so generals and admirals and so forth, that have talked openly and honestly about the deplorable state of the British Army and Navy. I mean, you're in such a fiscal nightmare that there has been open talk of selling aircraft carriers just to raise revenue. And in part because you can't staff them and you don't have the infrastructure to actually maintain them and get them seaworthy. Guess what, Colin? We face the same problem in the United States. This is not well understood. Our shipyards are a mess, right? A lot of the platforms that we rely upon are old. They are breaking down. We are short-staffed. Our human capital is low. I mean, it's not just, for example, that there is a recruiting crisis. I think there is in the United Kingdom as well, by the way. In other words, they can't find people. It's also that they can't retain them. People are sprinting to get out of the armed forces, full stop. And that's not unique to the United Kingdom or the United States. It's also true in France. At the same time, the Russians, just by way of example, they haven't even fully mobilized for war. And they have armies of hundreds of thousands operating in Ukraine and around Ukraine. The Chinese are about a third of the industrial production in the world today. They manufactured more commercial ships in 2024 than the United States has since World War II combined. The notion that we could launch a military attack or campaign against any of these powers is sheer lunacy. But as I said, that speaks to the cognitive dissonance, the absolute delusion that goes to the very highest levels. And back to your point earlier about Donald Trump, if you evaluate carefully a lot of the language that he uses, for example, he doesn't like Defense Department, so it's the Department of War. And what does he do on his birthday? He has a massive military parade. Like this is the 1950s. It ain't the 1950s, Donald. This is 2025. We got an economic emergency. We've got probably 50 million illegal immigrants in the United States, maybe more. And what he's done is sort of he's deployed these very small numbers of ICE agents that are quite literally overwhelmed by foreigners in cities like Chicago or Los Angeles. In other words, they can't assert federal law because we don't have the paramilitary forces to actually go in and impose it. And I would argue that that is exactly the condition that Great Britain finds itself in as well. In fact, there was a paper written, I don't know if you've read it, Colin, by David Betts, who I think is a professor of military history at King's College. And the paper is called The Future of War is Civil War. And he talks specifically about the prospect of civil conflict in the United Kingdom. And he says, if you go back to, I think it was 2011, when you had these marauding bands of arsonists and thugs across London that almost broke the London police force by itself. Well, I would submit that the situation in London today is considerably worse than that, considerably worse. So what's going to happen when these two groups, the white Britons, I should just say Britons, but people like you and me, frankly, who are descended from the founding ethnos of that country, and the large numbers of foreigners that have acquired political power and organization and are increasingly violent on the street in an organized fashion, what happens when these two groups inevitably collide? Because they will. Well, I don't think the government is prepared for that. They should be. They should be paying attention to it, but I don't think they are. And I don't think they have a plan to deal with it. And I would suggest that is exactly the case in the United States, too. By the way, having been to France multiple times, the notion that the French, that also have a hollowed out police force, that have a hollowed out army, that the idea that they could rapidly suppress massive upheaval in Paris or other parts of that country, which are just ransacked. And I've been to Paris multiple times in the last couple of years. There is a very palpable sense of fear on the street among the more discerning Frenchmen that, hey, yeah, shit's going to hit the fan. And eventually that might break containment, that the government may fail to deal with it. So if you add it all up, you're exactly right. They're old, they're out of touch. And I think the problems that we're talking about, not only are they intensifying, but they're intensifying in a way that's extremely clear and transparent and obvious. And what's the response from the government? Censorship, virtue signaling, exactly the same talking points as 10 years ago. Except now, I don't think any of that's working anymore. And as I said, that's why we are entering into a new kind of politics, a kind of mass mobilization that is going to get Britons and Americans and Frenchmen into the street. And that doesn't necessarily mean protests. What it does mean is new political organization outside of the legal framework of government.
All right. Just one thing to add to what you've said is there was one aspect of the incompetence seems to be that everything costs a fortune to do now in government. Unbelievable amounts of bureaucracy and procurement stupidity, whatever it is, everything costs a fortune. And there's this thing about the some American fighter jet that they've been designing, I think, since the 80s or something crazy like that. Yeah. And it's cost hundreds, billions. And then Russia and China seem to be able to just do things very quickly. And there was this thing about 2 years ago where China sent a hypersonic missile, and it circled the earth and hovered over America for a while. I can't remember exactly what it was, but the American security services said, yeah, this happened, and we didn't see it coming, and we have no way to stop one of these missiles. If they were to launch a war against us, we would have no way to stop these missiles. And I thought that was an astonishing admission to make, very unwise admission to make, which in turn made me think, are they lying? And that's a bluff. But either way, it seems, and again, I'm not saying this to sing the praises of Russia or China, it just seems to be the case that they are much more agile and resourceful than the West today. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes, I have a lot to say about that. Part of what is happening as we speak, it has nothing to do with politics per se, as much as it does administrative rot and obsolescence. Right? When you go to Asia, to a lesser extent Russia, but when you go to Asia, what you'll see are new airports, new superhighways, new, bullet trains, all those sorts of things. Some of that is not, the dynamism necessarily of the Chinese as much as it is they built new stuff. We haven't had a major infrastructure build out since the 1950s. I know in Great Britain, the National Health Service is a disaster. It is a diabolical mess, in part because these programs have never been modernized, right? The administrative state has eaten itself. And so a large part of what's gone on is, I would say, a sort of self-perpetuating grift machine. And you have to understand that, you know, I suspect this is true in England too, but you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong. But if you want to get rich, go to Washington, D.C., work for the government, right? That's how you're going to get rich. Become a government contractor, become a lobbyist. That's where the money is. So when you drive, you know, in Virginia or Maryland, these are some of the states adjacent to the Capitol, you'll see Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Teslas. You'll see these McMansions, right? Howard Lutnick, who I mentioned earlier, who is a former CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, is one of these Wall Street firms. He bought, Colin, a $25 million mansion from Bret Baier when he moved to D.C. to be part of the administration. $25 million, right? So you're talking about a massive theft of wealth from the public coffers. That's been going on for a long time because there's not been any legitimate supervisory authority. And this is not just about the administrative state either. It's not just about the healthcare systems or infrastructure or economy. It's also about the intelligence services. So, you know, in the United States, the CIA goes back to 1947, and the CIA was supposed to report to the president. And it, to some degree, it was given a wide berth, because we were operating the Cold War and it had to do certain things that were almost certainly going to be unconstitutional. However, there was never any adjustment by the elected government to scale any supervision of that agency whatsoever. So basically what it's become is Spectre, right? When people ask me about the intelligence suite in the United States, I say, well, have you watched Rogue Nation with Tom Cruise? Because that's kind of what it is. The syndicate is real. Or if you're going to talk in James Bond terms, we're talking about Spectre. That's basically what the intelligence agencies have become. Why? Because there's no supervision. There is no check on that power. Nobody's actually managing these agencies anymore. And that's a microcosm of the entire government. And so to a large extent, what's happened is absolute negligence on the part of elected bodies that have no capacity whatsoever to govern the administrative state and its appendages. And so now everything's completely out of control. And a lot of what's happening, you know, for example, like this war in Venezuela, a lot of people think, well, the president is sort of steering this. Not really. What the president represents is a figurehead. What drives a lot of these things are subversive agencies far below and far removed from the White House. And I think the same thing is true in Whitehall, right? Or at 10 Downing Street. Certainly, I think that's true on the continent as well. We know, right, that the elected bureaucracy, yeah, they implement a whole bunch of crap, but who knows what layer upon layer upon layer of bureaucrats iterate on top of that. And then you've got this sort of Orwellian tyrannical state. That's where we are. The good news, though, is it all operates on a base layer, and that base layer is the financial system. And I can't stress enough, Colin, that what the Western world is facing right now is a financial cataclysm, the likes of which I think is going to wipe out the global financial system as constructed from about 1815, when the Brits defeated Napoleon and the British Empire really came into its own. And then sort of conjoined with the Fed in 1916, in the midst of World War I, to create this Anglo-American monetary empire. This financial cataclysm that's affecting all of Europe, all the bond markets, it's affecting the banks. That financial demolition is going to rip apart everything that I just described. And that will clear a path for a reformism that I think will fix everything. The collateral damage is going to be severe. And there's no question that the social cohesion, it's not going to be tested. It's going to break. However, that will provide us with the opportunity that we need. And that is to reorganize and reform the whole damn thing.
Excellent. So how, when you say it will be an economic catastrophe, can you paint that in real terms for people and also perhaps give them some advice on how to survive that catastrophe?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, if you recalibrate the economic metrics in the United States, so specifically I'm talking about the poverty line, which officially is about $32,000 per year for a household of four. This is a statistic that goes back to the 1960s. If you recalibrate that, as I suggested earlier, and you use $140,000 a year to, you know, to account for all of the inflationary costs that you mentioned, Colin, then basically your middle class is gone. The middle class that defined America's ascent as an industrial power from about 1870 until 1970, a 100-year period of spectacular dominance. Basically, that entire population is living at the behest of the state. It subsists on some kind of redistribution from government. That could be food stamps, it could be Medicare, it could be Medicaid, it could be aid for student loans, any number of things. So the state has had to pick up and carry more and more of the social burden. This is exactly what's happening in the United Kingdom and France, where it's not just the French, it's not just the Brits. Now you have all these foreigners that you're paying for and paying an inordinate amount of money for. Well, what I'm proposing, what I'm suggesting is that has caused a kind of strain that's beginning to generate a feedback loop. Higher and higher interest rates, more and more debt that's being issued, and at the same time, an economy that, as we outlined earlier, an economy that's completely hollowed out, that's deindustrialized, right? That basically is thriving on a gambit called artificial intelligence, which itself is another Ponzi scheme that I'm happy to talk about as well. But in any case, as the government has loaded itself up more and more with debt, and the financial system and the government are basically merged together, as that sort of careens out of control. And as I said, I think this is happening now. I think it's unfolding. And to be clear with all of you, all you got to do is look at the UK gilts or look at US Treasury bonds. You can look at the French bond market. And interest rates for the last 3 or 4 years have done nothing but go up. And they've gone up pretty meteorically. That means that you're sort of in a feedback loop. There isn't a whole lot that can be done until it pops. And that basically means that you go from paying 4 or 5% interest to about 20% interest. Now, this happened in Greece about 15 years ago. And that meant that people's retirements were gone, that their pensions were gone, that their healthcare benefits were gone. And it didn't happen in a phased fashion because the Greek government hadn't planned for this, right? Which is sort of par for the course. So you went from, you know, hairdressers retiring at 55 on full benefits, sort of living the cushy life, presumably in their timeshare on the Greek coast, to all of a sudden the money flow stops. And what that meant was a kind of bankruptcy that brought people into the streets. That's where we're heading. And as I said, I think this is unfolding now. This is not a sort of abstraction anymore. Now, reflexively, people will say, well, yeah, but they can print money, right? Ultimately, the Bank of England can print money or the Fed can print money. The problem with that is as follows. If that were even remotely true, every investor in the world would own Zimbabwe stocks. They don't. Why don't they own Zimbabwe stocks? Well, because Zimbabwe isn't the United Kingdom. Well, why is Zimbabwe not the United Kingdom? Can't they just print money too? Because it's not the printing. It's the confidence. It's the trust. It's the social contract that actually keeps the system together. And that social contract is now breaking. And some of the incompetence that we've discussed, the warmongering overseas, the social unrest, you know, the masses of foreigners, they're all eroding that social contract as we speak. When that goes, they can print as much money as they want and interest rates will go higher, which historically is exactly what happens. So that's what it's going to look like. Now, how bad does it get? I don't know. At this stage, it's probably a fool's errand to suggest that. but it is going to get pretty bad. People are going to lose their pensions. I think a lot of people in the United States, for example, they're going to probably be foreclosed upon. Their stock portfolio is going to collapse of some serious magnitude, and that will cause tremendous anger and backlash, right? That could get pretty ugly, to be sure. But I do think it will sort of stop in its tracks this tyrannical Western globalist government or governments right away, like a sudden sort of heart attack to the system. What can we do about it? Well, I think there are a few things. The first is you've got to be aware of what we're describing as possible, because what a lot of people do is they're sort of overwhelmed by what I've just described. Oh, well, that can't happen. The authorities will take care of me. You need to let go of that fantasy. If COVID didn't teach you that, and the special military operation hasn't taught you that, and these race riots haven't taught you that, I don't know what will. But you need to sort of unplug from the illusion that the authorities are going to take care of you, that they're going to fix the banking system, that they're just going to print money and everything's going to be fine. That's the first thing you need to do. The second is you need to establish some degree of a communal network. Obviously, we facilitate that to some degree with channels like Collins and a host of other people. But you need to network with other people who are like-minded, so that you can help people get through these tough times. If there is a vacuum of power, which is essentially what I'm suggesting, you're going to need to form those networks, those unofficial networks, to get you through. And thirdly, start preparing in a practical sense. So if you have debt that needs to be paid down, do the best that you can to pay it down. Try to improve your credit. Try to raise as much cash as you can. Definitely have money on hand. Accumulate things like gold and silver. Learn about cryptocurrency. Maybe cryptocurrency is not the saving grace, but it is a mechanism by which you can exit the banking system. Because take it from me, if you consider financial crises historically, what governments tend to do is lock your money up. And then they raid your accounts so that they can subsidize their own spending. You don't want to find yourself in that position. So to some degree, divest from that. So those are the three things, Colin, that I'd represent. Number one, be self-aware. Don't turn away. Number two, build those informal networks as much as you can. And number three, take those practical steps. Raise capital, have things like gold and silver, learn about cryptocurrency. Do your best to pay down debt and be responsible yourself. Because in the tough times to come, those habits will serve you well, particularly as you get new currencies and we enter into some kind of a new monetary regime, which is, I think, what we're going to see happen.
All right. And then you've talked several times about the need for a new paradigm and the inevitability of a new paradigm. You also said that America is behaving as if it's still in an old paradigm, which is rapidly dissolving. Let's think specifically about America. We can talk about other countries as well later, perhaps. But let's, with regard to America, what kind of America would you like to see in the future? What kind of America would be compatible with the global paradigm that you see now emerging?
Part of the confusion with this question, and you'll see this a lot from folks that are predisposed to attack our point of view on this. You know, you can call them establishment or globalists or whatever. They'll sort of paint with a broad brush. They'll say, well, people that want an aggressive change to the system, what I would call a transformational change or a paradigmatic shift, you are necessarily authoritarian. This is an improper way to look at it. And to some degree, it's a false binary, right? Either you accept this sort of democratic decay, the dissolution of the social contract and your demographic replacement, or you're an authoritarian that wants to install the Third Reich. No, that's not the way the game is played. We are entering into a phase that has been called a state of exception. And there's a very interesting book written by the same name by an Italian philosopher called Agamben. It's called A State of Exception. And basically what that is the gap between the old regime and the new regime. How is that resolved? Well, historically, it's been resolved by a concentration of power. And here I would use Hobbes's term, a Leviathan. A Leviathan does not necessarily mean a man on horseback, right? It does not necessarily mean a Caesar or a Napoleon. What it does mean is that there is a temporary cessation of the rule of law as we understand it in a normative democratic society. And that is necessary because the whole machinery of government is so screwed up that you sort of have to shut it down and then you have to reset it. But in order to get there, you need a transitional movement. I have argued that this sort of mass mobilization, which I know is a vague term, and to some degree it's necessarily vague, because this time's going to look a little bit different. I don't think it's going to be Caesarism per se, but what you're going to see is a kind of movement that is corporate, that is grassroots, that is media-based, that is monetary-based, you know, communities like the Bitcoin community. All of these things are going to sort of fuse together. And by the way, I don't think that that is going to happen just locally in the United States. In fact, I think you're going to see Western peoples across the West conjoin in this effort. So you could sort of see an international movement of sorts to restore sovereignty in all these countries. That means communication. That means mutually reinforcing policies like remigration and so forth. In any case, you're going to see a Leviathan. You're going to see a kind of Hobbesian moment in which the rule of law temporarily breaks down and some organizing force, probably led by a vanguard, a new cadre of people. And I've suggested that sort of the inklings of one are already emergent, right? This is what you see from online personalities that have very, very large followings. I'm not suggesting that they per se will be the Leviathan. What I'm saying is that they are the staging ground, right? They are the organizing community, if you will, that's going to coagulate into this Leviathan that's going to come into power and fix this mess. And I would argue that it's not just the Constitution that's sort of just going to default, right? Default, by the way, means to deceive. It's a Latin term. And I think it's important to use that term, Colin, because the premise of the Constitution, the premise of all constitutions, is that there's a sharp delineation between citizen and non-citizen. That difference has been exploded. It has disintegrated. And this is what you hear in the United States. You hear the same thing in Great Britain and in France. Well, these people have the same rights as you have. Even illegal immigrants in the United States, by the letter of the law, the Constitution supports the idea that they have due process. Okay. Well, in theory, maybe that sounds appropriate, but did the Constitution account for an entire invasion of the country? Of course not. And that suggests that that constitutional framework of government is invalid. It is illegitimate. And in an English application or in a UK sense, that means parliament, the parliamentary form of government that I think has been in place more or less since 1701. That's over. And so in England, what you could see is the emergence of a kind of new monarchy that dissolves the parliament and establishes a new order in a Cromwellian kind of sense. It's not going to look exactly like that, but it will be something like that. And remember that that's what Thomas Hobbes wrote the Leviathan. That's what he lived through. He lived through that period. That's what you're living in. That's why I use this term succession, because the old order is done. And in the old days, that used to be a king, right? Well, now it's not a king. It's sort of an institution. And in Great Britain, it's the institution of parliament and its various parties, which are all fucked. Pardon my French. But that is the case. And the one man, I've heard, who's addressed this point to some degree, and I'm not saying he has the answer, but Rupert's, I think his name is Rupert Smith, who's talked about creating a movement of sorts outside of Parliament.
Rupert Lowe. Rupert Lowe. Rupert Lowe.
Thank you. Rupert Lowe. Yes. Rupert Lowe. That's sort of the correct way to think about it. In the United States, it's the Constitution. So to answer your question, what would I like to see? Well, the Constitution in the United States was always sort of an anachronistic document. So we need a kind of Leviathan to come in and rewrite that document to re-enshrine, if you will, a distinction between citizen and non-citizen and upgrade, reform the government. So that probably means a constitutional Congress of some kind or a constitutional assembly of some kind. That's where we're headed. But I suspect that that will not come at the beginning. It will likely come at the end of this sort of period of exception, right? The state of exception, which is going to be a very fraught period.
And what is the place, if any, of democracy in the future of the West?
Democracy per se is not necessarily the problem, right? It's the subversion of democracy. As I said, right? It's the conflation of citizen with demos, right? Just because somebody can vote, and this is the argument that you hear from people in Parliament, this is the argument you hear from people in the United States. Well, they can vote. Well, they're voters. Well, that's not a citizen. That in and of itself does not necessarily invalidate the principle of democracy, but democracy is not self-correcting. And so you're going to see a transitional kind of government that will reimpose order, that will sort of rejuvenate a social contract, and then we will get back to some kind of democratic form of government. But my suspicion is that you will probably end up with something that's more concentrated. You'll have some kind of more sovereign, and sovereign means super, above. There'll be something that stands above. You know, I like this term king in the sense that it speaks to something that transcends, right? That's more metaphysical. I'm not exactly sure what that's going to be. The Constitution itself, Colin, in the United States is viewed that way, which is why a lot of what I'm saying to a lot of Americans, particularly Trump supporters, is sort of a blasphemy. But it's not blasphemy if you understand that the Constitution and the social contract that it represents are broken, right? But in order to reinstitute that, you're going to have some kind of new sovereign authority. During the American Revolution, those sort of became the founding fathers. So maybe it's a team of people, sort of like the Meiji Restoration in Japan, a cadre that goes into government and fixes everything, and they become sort of the new elites, the new founders. It could be something like that. Whatever it's going to be, it's got to be sovereign. It's got to be above, right? It has to speak for the ethnos and transcend politics.
Right. I mean, you might have the reforming fathers in the future. You might hear people speaking about that. This is maybe a silly question, but I think it's one that people would want me to ask. What kind of time frame do you think we're talking about here? Because looking around, I remember when I visited America in 2016, and even then, you could see decay, and I was surprised because I still had this image of America from watching children's movies in the 80s and 90s, you know. And so I thought that it was going to be sort of, I mean, I wasn't stupid about it, but I just thought that it was going to be a well looked after country. And instead, what I saw was, as I say, decay and degradation, in the buildings and the roads and so on. And I was surprised. And from what I've heard, it's despite Trump's first presidency and now it's only got worse since then. And certainly in Britain, it's the same thing. You alluded to London earlier. Yeah, indeed, you can walk around London and think, what the hell is going on? Nothing seems to work quite properly. Some things are just disasters. Some things don't work at all. And yet, a lot of people will say, it looks bad, but the system can rumble on for a long time, for much longer than you think. that this could keep going for another 20, 30, 50 years. What would you say about that? Do you think we're talking about 100 years from now, 50 years from now, 5 years from now? What would you say?
Colin, this is an excellent question, and a lot of people consider this the question. You can never know the transformative moment looking forward. You can only know looking backwards, right? That's just one of those paradoxes of history. I think we're already in this period. You could argue that it started with Donald Trump in 2016. I don't think so. I think COVID, in many ways, was the beginning of the end of the old regime. One of the things to note about this is that people have great difficulty with endings and beginnings. They have great difficulty with that. I'm going to give you some examples of exactly what I mean. When I was 6 years old, I was living in Germany, and my memory is pretty good. So I remember vividly when the Gulf War started in 1990, and watching my father deploy to fight in that war. And at the time, he was a cavalry officer, so that meant that he was operating, you know, these armored tanks and so forth. And I remember going to the tarmac where he was going to get in one of those cargo planes and fly away to the war. And you could see pretty much as far as the eye could see, tanks, Bradleys, Humvees, you know, the sprawling largesse of America's industrial might. By the way, that is the world that the elites still think that they're in, which is why the Eurocrat lunatics, and especially your prime minister, I'm sad to say, are desperate to plunge the United States into this war with Russia, because they still see us as this industrial colossus that can make quick work of the Russians. In any case, in 1990, when I saw that, the prevailing wisdom at the time, and you probably remember this well, I think you're about my age, Francis Fukuyama and the end of history was extremely popular. And the assumption was, in fact, I would say it was practically dogmatic, was that this was the beginning of Pax Americana, unchallenged dominance over the world. And yet it was sort of the peak. And then everything sort of started to peter out from there at the precise moment that everybody asserted that that was not the case. I'm going to give you another example. I remember in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, I was still in the Navy at the time, and I was just on the verge of leaving the service. And Obama was elected. And when he was elected, there was a sort of tremendous euphoria in the United States, even from people that voted against him. And the implication then was that Obama represented the end of racial politics and polarity in the United States.
He was the first post-racial president. I remember that. Exactly. And hope and change. Exactly. Yeah.
He was the first post-racial president. And by virtue of being biracial himself, he was sort of like a shaman whispering to the masses, this is the way forward. And everybody at the time thought that. And I remember thinking, this ain't going to work at all. This is a disaster. And within a couple of years, you got the Tea Party, which was always sort of alt-right light. You know, these people were there because they knew that the country was in ruins, that it was in trouble, but they didn't want to articulate exactly why. So they stuck to sort of vanilla issues. But then you got Trump in 2016, okay? So in 2008, again, endings and beginnings. Well, actually, it wasn't the beginning of a post-racial America at all. If anything, it was the escalation of racial conflict in the United States. Fast forward to 2024. Donald Trump is elected basically as the savior. People think that this guy's going to come in and he's going to stitch everything up and save the republic. And Colin, not only is that a load of odorous excrement, but Donald Trump is the last president of this sort of pluralistic age of America. He's the end. And my suspicion is, to answer your question, he will not finish his term. because this financial catastrophe is rapidly spreading. And I know that this is a subject that your audience and people that are political by default, they don't really, they're not terribly interested in it. But if you study the financial plumbing as I have, and you observe what is happening in Japan, the second most important currency in the world is the yen, and the yen is imploding. It's taken 30 years to get here, but it's falling apart. And you look at the various sovereign financial systems, especially France and Europe, especially the UK, they're a mess and they're rapidly deteriorating. I mean, very, very quickly. It is not well understood in the United States. Maybe it's more understood in Great Britain, but Liz Truss in 2022, in the fall of 2022, the Bank of England and the UK government almost defaulted. That almost happened. And you may not know exactly the mechanics, but at the time, the Bank of England was doing exactly what the Federal Reserve Bank was doing, raising interest rates to combat inflation. And then something blew up. You have all these pension funds in the United Kingdom that had flooded into UK gilts, treasuries. And because interest rates were rising, the value of these gilts were falling precipitously. And so all of a sudden, all these pension funds had to liquidate because of this strategy they pursued called liability-driven investment. They basically bet everything on government bonds. By the way, the banks across the Western world have done the same thing. All of a sudden, they had to liquidate a lot of these bonds, and the Bank of England held an emergency meeting and almost certainly had back channels to the Fed in New York City, and they reversed course overnight. They created an asset purchase facility, and they pulled Great Britain back from the brink. A few months after that, Silicon Valley Bank blew up in the United States, and then that fall, we had a sort of a rupture in our bond market. This has started. We're in it. So I don't think Donald Trump is going to finish his term, is the short of it. And then you're going to see something similar to what's happened in Great Britain. You're going to cycle through, sort of grind down prime minister to prime minister, president to president, until the government sort of breaks. And that will look something like the French Revolution, I think. And when it really starts to go, it's going to go very fast. And to give you a historical example of this, in early June of 1789, Robespierre gives a speech to the Estates General. And that about a month later, I want to say a month and a half later, comes the storming of the Bastille, and boom, you're in the French Revolution. Fast forward 10 years, in November of 1799, Napoleon charges into the Palace of the Tuileries, and he says, "Citizens, you are dissolved." And he becomes Emperor of France. 10 years. We are very close, dangerously close, to that sort of Robespierrean moment, to that Estates General. Is it a matter of years or months? I don't know. But it will be determined by the gods of finance, or perhaps the clowns in D.C. or Brussels will fumble their way into a war that catalyzes it anyway. Either way, we're in it. We're in this sort of precarious moment of peril now. So no, I don't see it decades away. And I think if you look carefully at what's happening on the streets of Paris and London and Berlin and major cities in the United States, you can sort of feel it.
Right. That's much sooner than I was expecting. When you ask people to give a prediction of something, they usually say, well, 5, 10, 20 years. I didn't think you would say more like a matter of months. That's surprising. But I can see why. I can see your reasoning. I can understand it.
Just to be clear here, this is important. The United States is spending like $50 billion a day. A day. We are issuing $500 billion of IOUs every month. You know what it was in 2013? It was $100 billion at much lower rates. Again, people are not paying attention. I do. And specifically, you have to remember that the way all the government bond markets work is they go from auction to auction to auction. What I mean is they quite literally, they hold an auction and they issue bonds to the banks. And what's happened is that in order to buy that government debt, these vendors, these creditors are saying, I want higher and higher and higher in interest. And what happens, Colin, is that the relationship no longer becomes linear. It becomes nonlinear. All of a sudden, you go from zero to 60. And see, this is the problem with the model that, well, you know, you're sort of in this slow decline. Well, you go broke very slowly and then all at once. And if you consider then the political implications, the racial problems that we've got, you know, sort of the alarmism, the conspiracy about what's happened in government, right? Here I'm talking about people like Epstein or pedophilia or Satanism. It all reinforces one another. So it lends itself to animal spirits that rapidly swing into motion and then bang, you're in a massive crisis. I'm suggesting to you that we're very close to that.
All right. That's amazing. Okay. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. And it's not gone quite as I was expecting it to go. So my apologies if I haven't interacted quite as much as I usually do. But I also thought that it was fine to just let you tell this story. There are a few super chats. If people have more, now would be the time to post them, because the next guest is due in 15 minutes. But we'll get through these. Hold on a second. Okay, Donald Ducktator, that's a good name, says, who was the greatest predictor of the human condition in the 21st century, and why is it Ted Kaczynski?
Yeah, good old Ted Kaczynski. Yeah, I mean, industrial society and its future, although I would argue, ironically, it's been sort of the deindustrialization of the West that has fanned the flames of revolution, isn't it? Which is sort of the antithesis of what he suggested. But either way, one major problem with Kaczynski, and I can't stress this enough, three words, ladies and gentlemen, and I emphasize this for anybody that has watched the backlash or watched my content, you've heard me mention this: external locus of control. I guess four words: external locus of control. External locus of control is a psychological effect in which you believe that you are a victim, that you do not have agency. And you'll notice that there is a sort of mirroring that's going on here between people on the left and people on the right. People on the left, oh, the system is again, I'm a victim, right? There's systemic racism. And of course, when you ask them to elaborate, they can't, because it's made up, right? It's an illusionary monster. But then people on the right, oh, it's the elites. It's the super elites who control all the banks and are carefully, surgically manipulating our downfall, and therefore we can't do anything. External locus of control. And I think Kaczynski fell victim to that, and it drove him out of his mind. Do not succumb to that. We all have agency. We are all going to impact the future, as I've described, more so than you might think. Because in times of crisis, that's when you're going to see the archetypes of Western man really come to the fore. And this is something, Colin, people just do not understand. Civilization is not founded on passivity or good times. It's founded on moments very akin to what we're going into. And usually that means that one group of people is going to rise to the occasion, and I think we will.
Good. All right. And Ranulf says, I currently live in Russia. I moved here from the US. It isn't a white ethnostate, but it is majority Slavic Russian. And a lot of things here are quite nice. No transgenderism or race mixing adverts. There we go. Thank you, Ranulf. I think that was probably posted when you were talking about Russia. Mm-hmm. Don asks, does Cameron chop wood, etc.? I don't know if that's a euphemism for something else.
No, I do not chop wood.
All right. Okay, and Pat says, great conversation. Cameron is a pleasure to listen to. Well, thank you, Pat. Of course, we can end it there, but I would say, what if your prediction that it's going to happen, that Donald Trump isn't going to end his first term, end his second term, what would you, if that doesn't happen, are you ready for that? Because, you know, obviously people have made predictions in the past and then they don't come to pass, and the person generally has to, people react in different ways. You seem to be a careful man, you seem to be very analytical, and yet you're making a very, very big prediction here. You seem to be very confident about it.
Predicting the future is a hazardous affair, to be sure. There's no question about that. But sometimes in your analysis, you have to subordinate the thinking mind from the intuition, from the instinct. And my instincts, my intuition, in addition to circumstantial evidence analysis, suggests that we are at an inflection point, that we are reaching a denouement. I think that Donald Trump, not just because of the reasons I outlined, you know, this sort of ineffectual nature of his administration, but I think he's an old man and he's fading. I think he's under tremendous stress. I think that anybody, any man would be at this stage. He's essentially presiding over a catastrophe. He's taken control of a train that is derailing. Is he privy to that? Does he have some awareness of it? He probably does. Not to the degree that we've discussed it here. By no means do I think that. If he did, he probably would have set out the presidential election, right? But I think that he is sitting on a tinderbox. I think the same goes for Keir Starmer. I got the same sense when I was in France with Macron. And that is to say that it is impossible to know precisely what is coming, but I think the animal spirits, and I do think that's sort of an appropriate term in the sense that they are turning. Now, that being said, to answer your question, Colin, because it is a good question, you know, what happens if I'm wrong, or when, you know, no doubt a lot of people will point to that. No question that I could be wrong. Maybe these things take a little bit longer. Maybe the central bankers have levers that they can pull that, you know, I cannot anticipate. That could be the case. It will not, in my opinion, drastically change the arc of history that we're on. History is unpredictable. Human systems are chaotic systems. They're nonlinear, right? They are unpredictable, and they are very sensitive to initial conditions. So it's very hard to assert that there is an inevitability of things. That being said, I think we are on a collision course. And a lot of the problems that we're dealing with today were predicted by people like Enoch Powell, you know, 50 years ago, right? Certainly they were in the United States. It wasn't all that difficult to see that they were coming. The only thing that's happened is they've just gotten worse. They've gotten spectacularly worse. So if I'm wrong about the timing, it just means that the picture is going to get a lot worse. It'll just take longer to get there. You know, in a sense, the sooner this happens, Colin, the better. Then we can start to deal with it. Is there a chance that they're able to kick this can down the road another 20 years, and that's sort of the end of the West? Yeah, that's possible. That could happen. But I don't think that's the way that it's going to go. And by way of an example, just consider what's happened in the last 5 years. Just look at that small snapshot. A global pandemic that's completely turned society upside down. A major war that's displaced or killed millions of people. A veritable Holocaust in the Middle East that not only has killed tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of children, by the way, with armaments and equipment provided by the West, and especially the United States, but also, and concomitantly, the invalidation of Zionism as a global force. I mean, yeah, maybe they control these governments, but Israel is a pariah state. What about the awareness of the JQ? I mean, it has gone viral and fast, and it's spreading even quicker as we speak. So all of those things would have been impossible even 10 years ago. Impossible. And Colin, I think you can attest to that, right? These were sort of discussions that you were holding in a subterranean layer on the internet. Now they're on Piers Morgan.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's amazing how fast all of this has changed. And also one thing you didn't mention that I think has also changed is just racial awareness. It's happening more on the basis of ethnicity. People don't say race, but it is the same thing. That's a thing that I think people are now very conscious of, that they just weren't 5 years ago. So, yeah, I completely agree. Things have
accelerated. And real quick, the implication too, and you remember hearing this. I heard this a lot. Colin, believe it or not, I used to have these conversations when I was in high school. I was never really red-pilled for reasons that, you know, I can go into in a future discussion. But I grew up in a household that was very tethered to tradition. Let's just call it like that. So I was privy to these things. It did not make my life any easier. It was very difficult because for years and years, I knew these problems were festering and people just didn't want to deal with it. But there was an assertion for a long time that as more and more foreigners, non-whites, whatever, and more propagandizing went on, that racial awareness would just collapse. It would just dissolve. And the exact opposite has happened. And that should tell all of you where we are headed, right? There is a sort of inversion or a reversion, depending on how you want to look at it. And this is why I use the terms archetypes, right? There is an activation that's happening. And once you are aware, there is no more powerful weapon in the world than that awareness, that awakening, that apocalypse that is upon us. And that's the first step.
All right. Let's leave it there. This has been a fascinating conversation. I feel that it should have been twice as long, but I'm sorry. It's the format of Millennial. All right. Well, Cameron McGregor, well, this was your first time on Millennial. It's been a great interview. So thank you for doing it. I'll be back in 10 minutes with the next one. But Cameron, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
It's always a pleasure to speak with a fellow Scotsman.
It's been a real pleasure, so thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.